Will, can I ask you to maybe do the impossible, which is one of the questions we've got here?
Oh boy.
And John asks, how would a fire-informed university president have answered Congresswoman Elise Stefanik's question, does calling for the genocide of Jews violate your university's rules on bullying and harassment? Is it possible to answer a question about unprotected speech in one word?
Yeah, I mean, the answer would be maybe.
Freedom of speech.
Fundamental rights.
Freedom of conscience.
Academic freedom.
Freedom of press.
And the right to listen.
You're listening to So to Speak, the free speech podcast, brought to you by FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression.
I think we have a bunch of new folks to FIRE probably participating in this live webinar. So for those who are new to FIRE and the work that we do, we are the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression. For 23 years, we are focused on campus civil liberties issues, free speech, due process, academic freedom, religious liberty. And in 2022, we expanded our free speech mission off campus. And now we defend the free speech rights of all Americans. The conversation we're going to have today, however, is focused on campus. This is where our expertise has been for 25 years, and this is our moment. For those who are new to this format, we are going to get the conversation started by having a deep dive, doing a deep dive into the campus unrest, the various issues at play, the cases that we are seeing. But I want to take your all's questions. That's probably the best way to have this conversation, the most interesting way to have this conversation. So please, in the chat feature at the bottom of your screen, ask questions throughout the conversation, and we will address them throughout the conversation. If you end up liking this format, we do what we call member-only conversations every month, where we address all sorts of issues related to FIRE's mission. And you can become a FIRE member by going to thefire.org and donating $25. Become an annual member, $25 a year gives you access to those conversations. It also gives you access to other benefits such as FIRE events, early tickets to FIRE sponsored events, the FIRE quarterly, and many other goodies. So I think we're going to get started. Very quickly introduce my colleagues on this call. Will Creeley, FIRE's legal director. Will, welcome.
Howdy. Thanks for having me.
And Alex Morey, our Vice President of Campus Advocacy, recently promoted, formerly the Director of our Campus Rights Advocacy Department. Alex, welcome.
Thanks so much.
So Alex, I imagine that you have been quite busy within the campus vertical at FIRE these past couple of weeks. We have hundreds of protests on college campuses, more than 50 encampments, according to Bloomberg News as of Friday. There are more than 800 arrests, according to the New York Times, we checked this morning. So things have been hot on campus. What are you seeing in your departments?
Well, you know, we think that peaceful protest, you know, that can be a good sign of a healthy and habitable campus climate. We never want to see protests devolve into violence. We don't want to see peaceful protests preemptively shut down. A lot of the things that we have seen on campuses in the last week or two. And of course, it's been really difficult for us at FIRE because, you know, for decades now, we've been saying, you know, we've been trying to explain to people the kinds of policies, practices, and mindsets that we think and have seen play out on some campuses. You know, we think it could prevent a lot of these kinds of devolutions of peaceful protest into something that we don't want to see. So, you know, practically, we have been trying to analyze various situations that we're seeing play out in real time on X or in the media. We're trying to analyze it as fast as we can, try to figure out, is this protected? Is there a student or faculty rights violation at issue? If there is, we're urgently writing letters, we're providing commentary, we're filing public records requests, you know, and this is a team of like, you know, 10, 12 people plus with with assists from broader FIRE. So yeah, we've been really busy. And this is one of those situations where you can speak in broad, like, platitudes about, like, you know, free speech on campus is good. But when it comes down to the nitty gritty of what is protected in a given situation, it is going to be a fact intensive analysis every single time. And that's what we tell college administrators that they have to do every single time. And that's what we have to do every single time when we're looking at each given situation. So definitely a lot of hard work. We've got hardworking, caring, lovely people on our staff. And we're, you know, busting our butts to try to get everything tackled as fast as we possibly can.
That's the term of art. That is the correct
term. That is the legal. The Chemerinsky came up with that one. Yes.
I want to remind our participants to put any questions they have in the chat, and we will get to them throughout the conversation. Yeah, Alex, that's one of the challenges, right? When you're having a situation like the one we're seeing unfold at hundreds of campuses across the country, is that it's easy to paint all of the protests with a broad brush, all of it being protected free speech or assembly, all of it being civil disobedience, all of it being a violation of content neutral time, place, and manners restrictions, all of it being violence. But Will, it's a little bit more complicated than that, as we might expect.
Yeah.
What are the broad principles at play that folks should be mindful of when they're assessing, and that we're mindful of when we're assessing any given protest on any specific campus?
Well, Alex alluded to a couple of them. I'll just start with the basics. First of all, peaceful protest is protected. You have the right as a student to speak your mind on campus. And that is especially true at public university campuses, which are bound by the First Amendment. You don't check your First Amendment rights at the door as a student or faculty member. With one exception, you do check them at the classroom door. Folks, let me just preempt those comments. Wait a second. Are you telling me I have a First Amendment right to say whatever I want in class? No, you will be graded appropriately. But on the generally accessible public areas of campus, we consider those, and the law consider those, traditional public forums, or at the very least, designated public forums for students and faculty who have a right to be there. So that means that you can engage in a wide variety of expressive activity subject to reasonable time, place, and manner regulations. And here you can tell where I'm earning that adjective before director, legal director, right? This is where I'm going to get a little jargony. I'm going to try and keep it very, very simple. The time, place, and manner regulations basically govern what means you use, how you say something, right? If I say, no amplified sound on campus after 2 a.m. because people are sleeping. Well, that's a reasonable time, place, and manner restriction. Now, note here, very importantly, those reasonable restrictions have to be viewpoint and content neutral. So if I say no amplified sound on campus after 2 a.m., unless you're a member of the College Democrats, in which case go nuts, right? Now we're not viewpoint and content neutral anymore. We are discriminated against every view that's not a College Democrat or a College Republican, vice versa. So that's when you start running into problems. The reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions also have to allow for ample alternative means of expression, right? So you can't just shut down expression on campus completely. You also can't have rules that are just wildly unreasonable, even if they are viewpoint and content neutral. If you say that every protest or every expressive activity on campus has to be registered 2 weeks in advance, that might be viewpoint and content neutral, but it's not reasonable. So that's kind of the broad outlines of what's going on here. That's the first step. And I should note here that there are some types of expression or expressive conduct that are never protected by the First Amendment. Violence is never protected. Happily, incidents of violence appear to have been isolated here. True threats and intimidation, also not protected. Discriminatory harassment, properly defined, also not protected. These are very narrow, very specific definitions that do require context-based appraisals of what's going on here. So to your point, Nico, and to your point, Alex, and it's an excellent one, each situation has to be evaluated in context. And that's part of the work we do here every day, round the clock lately.
We have a question from Richard, who asks if we can explain the differences between free speech and private versus public campuses. Maybe we'll pitch that one over to Alex.
You go for it, Alex.
Sure. This one I can handle. The more detailed ones, maybe we get Will in here.
you can handle all of them, to be clear.
So on public, this is like the most common question that we get. Back to basics. Okay, so in public spaces, on public college campuses, this is government property on the open outdoor areas of public campuses. These are typically open for protest. There can be some, like Will said, reasonable time, place, and manner regulations imposed. And then we've got some states give extra protection to these open outdoor areas of campuses, like Texas, that have codified in state law that these areas are open for public protest. On private campuses can choose whether or not they elevate other values above freedom of expression, but the vast majority, particularly, you know, the big names, but, you know, the Harvards and the Yales, but the vast majority of private college campuses make First Amendment-like protests, First Amendment-like protections, including the right to protest on their campuses. That's why at Columbia, we've been holding them to a similar standard when we're saying, you know, hey, you can't cut off the open outdoor area of your campus to peaceful protest, because at the opening of your policy document, even though you're a private entity, you've got this First Amendment-like promise that opens all your policy documents that says we are not going to censor speech on our campus, even if it's controversial. It looks a lot like the First Amendment, and they make these carve-outs for we're only going to censor speech that might constitute violence or misconduct, and we're only going to impose content and viewpoint neutral time, place, and manner regulations. Now, there's a subset of schools that do elevate other values above free expression, you know, your very religious schools, your BYUs, your military academies, but we don't hassle them because they have the right to do that as a private entity. And they're very clear in their policy documentation. You know, when you sign up to go to BYU, you know, you don't have the same kind of free expression rights that you might at a public campus or a private campus that makes First Amendment-like promises.
We have a question about the encampment. So I want to turn now to Columbia, Will. Alex mentioned that at private schools that adopt First Amendment free speech standards that they're not required to do, but do so voluntarily, that in most cases, the outdoor areas of campus are free for student expression. Anyone who's been to Columbia knows there's this giant quad sitting right in the middle of campus where students are often engaging in expressive activities. But in recent weeks, they've set up an encampment 24 hours a day. The other encampments that you're seeing around campus have largely come in response to Columbia sending in the police to break that one down. So what is the free speech analysis surrounding encampments, and what can colleges, private and public, do in response to them?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's really kind of the crux of the whole matter at the moment. Colleges can regulate overnight camping on their you know, publicly accessible grounds. We were talking about reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions. I think a restriction against having students camp out in a public area, if it's applied even-handedly and it's published and on the books indefinite, that can be enforced. Now, how that enforcement happens is crucial. I think using law enforcement or force has to be an absolute last resort before moving students. Students have to be given notice that they're in violation of this rule, and any student who is disciplined for violating the rule, of course, has to be afforded procedural rights and due process and a fair hearing. Those are just the basics, again, of any kind of disciplinary proceeding. But that's really the crux of the matter here for us, is that you can have a restriction on camping overnight for any number of reasons. First of all, the college's interest in maintaining open access to its campus for all students, the college's interest in providing for the safety of students who are outside on its grounds after hours, and you can imagine those kind of operational interests, and those are significant enough that I think you could have a narrowly tailored viewpoint and content neutral restriction on camping. It certainly does allow for alternative means of protest. You can just protest during the day. But how those restrictions have been enforced or not enforced in the past has proven to be a flashpoint here.
Yeah. At Indiana University, for example, it sounds like their administration passed a policy banning encampments on Dunn Meadow. I'm a former Indiana University student, so I'm pretty familiar with that campus. As a way to forestall these sorts of encampments. Whereas previously, if our research is correct, for example, there was an encampment in Dunn Meadow for 45 days protesting, right, I believe, the first Iraq war. Right. So what can college and university administrators do in response to real-time protests to implement those sort of time, place, and manner restrictions? How must they consider their past actions, which, as we know, anyone who follows FIRE, are often not great with regard to free speech, in moving forward if they, for example, want to start using time, place, and manner restrictions now?
Well, let me be clear. I think any change to university policy that's motivated by a desire to preempt or silence a particular viewpoint is inherently suspect and should be regarded with great suspicion.
Well, can you talk about Greg Abbott's social media post in that regard?
Well, absolutely. But also Indiana University. Governor Abbott in Texas has singled out two pro-Palestinian student groups by name. He has made clear his distaste for pro-Palestinian viewpoints and some of the protesting on campus, and dispatched a shockingly large law enforcement response to campus to apparently preempt student protest. And that does not strike me as a reasonable response designed to protect the marketplace of ideas that is uniquely a public university canvas. In fact, it strikes me as contrary to that idea. Rather, it seems like a chilling threat to students who might voice viewpoints unpopular with the governor's office that they better stay home and shut up. And that's the kind of thing that as free speech advocates here at FIRE, we can't abide. But with regard to Indiana University, again, I think kind of passing a last ditch, quiet, all but off the books, change to university policy to forestall a protest. Again, I think that's problematic as well. Ideally, what you would have are well-established, even-handedly enforced, viewpoint and content-neutral restrictions that are reasonable, that are narrowly tailored, that allow ample alternative means of protest, and those should be on the books. Everybody should know about them. Everybody should be certain about their enforcement. It shouldn't be sometimes they're enforced and sometimes they're not. And if you're coming into a situation where they haven't been enforced in the past, as was apparently the case at Columbia and other universities, you have to be very clear about why you're enforcing them now and give students notice so that they can react appropriately. That's just what fundamental fairness here demands.
Well, you had mentioned open access to campus for all students as one of the reasons that you can enforce content neutral time, place, and manner restrictions. Some of the allegations are that these encampments or these pro-Palestinian protest groups are interrogating folks based on viewpoint before they can access, or journalists aren't able to come onto campus and report on them. What's the analysis there?
Yeah, that's unacceptable. I think the blocking access to campus for other students who don't share the viewpoint of a group that's occupying campus is itself restrictive. I don't think that that is in keeping with the university's role as the marketplace of ideas. I think that's a real problem. I think blocking physical access to parts of campus or conditioning access to parts of campus on, you know, agreeing with the viewpoint of a group that's holding a protest is a real problem, and that universities have to be able to allow for the free movement of all students around campus.
Alex, we have a question about the exceptions to the First Amendment for things like fighting words and incitement. And these words are often getting thrown around a lot surrounding these campus conversations as ways often to say that any given speech falls outside First Amendment protection or a private school's free speech standards. I just saw an interview with Mitch McConnell on Face the Nation this past week where he said you can't shout fire in a crowded theater. This is a common mantra often used by folks to justify censorship in any given context. So what are the standards for determining whether speech falls outside of First Amendment protection? What is the standard for incitement? What is the standard for fighting words to the extent it's still good doctrine? And what it is or is not protected under this kind of banner of hate speech?
Sure. So I guess I can
compound start. Question. Go. Good luck, Alex.
Yeah, we can tag team on this one, Alex, if you want.
Yes. Okay. I'll start. So the First Amendment does a really good job of setting the bar pretty high for unprotected speech. And that's because in the U.S., we really want the space for political discourse, even when it's, you know, unmeasured, even offensive, even hateful, to be wide open, because this is America. That's what we do here. But the First Amendment does set the bar at some conduct that can include speech that is unprotected and for good reason. So, for example, you cannot make a true threat, a serious expression of an intent to commit unlawful violence. We see, however, people say like, this feels threatening, or that he said that, and or this, these protesters are saying that, and that's a threat. 95% of the time, we are seeing speech that is not going to meet that standard, the serious expression of an intent to commit unlawful violence, and yet people are calling it a threat. Lots of concept creep there. Another one we see thrown around a lot are, you know, our claims of harassment. This is harassing. The fact of protesters on Columbia's campus that are pro-Palestinian are you know, harassing to Jewish students. In the educational context, you know, there is a Supreme Court standard for discriminatory harassment. It is, you know, it can include speech, but it needs to be, you know, unwelcome speech that is so severe, pervasive, and subjectively offensive.
Objectively offensive.
Objectively offensive. I've said this too many times. Objectively offensive, not subjectively. That's very important. You know, typically this is a pattern of conduct that effectively prohibits the victim student from availing themselves of an educational opportunity or benefit. So this is a high bar. It's not insurmountable. But again, we need these clear objective standards so that we don't have people saying, you know, somebody said something on X or Twitter, that's harassment, or somebody's protesting about something I find subjectively offensive, that is harassment. No, it needs to meet this standard, which is from 1999, Davis versus Monroe. The Supreme Court has said this is the standard, and unless you are going to meet that bar, it's not discriminatory harassment in the educational context.
And some of the justices worried that it wouldn't be speech protective enough, if I recall correctly.
But, you know, we see Davis harassment, you know, we see that bar met. It happens. It's not to say that harassment, discriminatory harassment, doesn't happen in the educational context. It does. And I think the Supreme Court did a good job of, you know, setting that bar high, but not insurmountable, because again, especially on public college campuses, private ones that make free speech promises, we want to see political discourse be as wide open as possible. With those rights, it comes the responsibility of sometimes having to hear viewpoints that you disagree with or that are upsetting to you, but that might not hit that bar. Other categories of unprotected speech, maybe I'll toss these over to Will, things like, you know, obscenity, libel, incitement to imminent lawless action. We've got our fighting words. You know, these are things we see less in the, maybe the incitement thing we've seen pop up a few times in the last week or so, questions about incitement. But typically it's the true threats, the harassment, and then things like, you know, vandalism that we are seeing pop up right now on certain college campuses.
I want to just say thank you right now to everybody that we have not seen an obscenity angle in the current protests. I'm very relieved by that. There's been enough going on. Incitement is speech that is both directed to inciting or producing imminent lawless action and is likely to incite or produce such action. So we have this question, and we thought about this a lot with the congressional hearings and the three university presidents back in, 6 million years ago?
December.
With regard to, quote unquote, calls for genocide. If I am a student and another student says, from the river to the sea, Palestine shall be free, I may find that speech repulsive and distasteful, but that does not yet, standing alone, cross the line into discriminatory harassment or incitement. Now, again, context matters here. That was an unpopular thing to say in that congressional hearing, but it is absolutely the case. If that same student says, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, and is holding a weapon of some kind, we haven't seen that happen, just to be clear, but if that was the situation, then yes, that starts looking more like a true threat. If that same phrase is next followed by, okay, you know what to do, let's get this student, okay, now we're talking about incitement again, or a true threat, or again, discriminatory harassment. Context really does matter here. The baseline from both the First Amendment standpoint and for FIRE as a free speech advocate is that the vast majority of speech is protected. These exceptions are narrow, they're carefully defined, and for universities to fulfill their role in producing tomorrow's leaders in our pluralistic democracy, it has to stay that way.
It can one-off remarks meet the harassment standard articulated in Davis?
That's a very good question. I tend to think no. I don't think. I mean, this is why, you know, to borrow a quick page from our Title IX sex-based discrimination discussions, which are also going on at the moment, like we haven't had enough to do over here lately. In that situation, just to get in the weeds for a second, the Department of Education is arguing that the, in fact, now mandating that the harassment standard be speech that is severe or pervasive. Before it can produce what's known as a hostile environment and constitute actionable hostile environment harassment. Severe or pervasive is different than severe, pervasive, and objectively offensive. I think under severe or pervasive, a particular one-off expression might constitute harassment. I don't think that should be the result under the First Amendment. I think the First Amendment requires more. I think the speech has to be, and this is exactly what the justices were debating in Davis v. Monroe County Board of Education, Nico, which you alluded to before, 5-4 decision with Justice Kennedy leading the dissent saying this isn't really speech protective enough. He was worried about exactly those kinds of one-off expressions. That's why we have the standard that's severe, pervasive, and objectively offensive, not just subjectively offensive, but a speech that a reasonable person would find offensive. That's a higher standard. I think free speech demands a higher standard.
And I would ask also folks who are more sympathetic to one-off remarks meeting that standard to think about how that standard might be used against speech that they like. Right.
Absolutely.
If we give administrators the power to determine what is a severe statement and therefore punishable as harassment, it will often be used against minorities on campus. It'll be wielded against conservatives. If you are a Jewish student or a pro-Israel student, it will be wielded against you. In fact, FIRE was founded in the wake of the Water Buffalo case at the University of Pennsylvania in the 90s, where a hate speech code was essentially used as a, against a Hebrew-speaking Israeli student who shouted, you know, "Shut up, you water buffalo," out of his dorm room window. Water buffalo roughly translates to behemoth, essentially. So he was making a rough translation in his head, which means, you know, which is used often, I think, in Yiddish as a loud or unruly person. That was one remark. And he was punished under University of Pennsylvania's codes. So we need to be careful when we're deciding to give the government or college administrators at a private school the power to determine what is hateful or what is harassment based on a single remark. But then the question becomes, well, is what if you have a bunch of individuals saying things one off? Can right. that then in the aggregate create a hostile environment?
Yeah, this is a big question for us lately. And I am very concerned about this theory. Someone smart called it to me a distributed theory of harassment, where each individual speaker says something that on its own would be and is properly protected by the First Amendment, but then in the aggregate and they snowball and create a larger hostile environment harassment. I think that's a real problem. I think that in a situation like that, there's no appropriate remedy for the school. They can't punish each individual speaker for saying something that's protected. That would just silence a great deal of protected political expression. I think in that situation, what the school must do is ensure the safety of students who feel as though they are being singled out. They must ensure that no action does cross that line. But they can't silence individual instances of protected speech simply for contributing to a larger environment. I don't think that that remedy can be allowable, because it would essentially eliminate the right to speak. No one speaker can be cognizant of all the other speech that's happened on the campus and then adjust their behavior accordingly. That's just untenable.
Alex, I want to ask you, we have a question from William. What are administrators allowed to do regarding non-student or faculty organizing on campus? If you think about Columbia, this is a campus in the middle of New York City. Although, Will, you're an NYU grad. Correct me if I'm wrong. NYU didn't have any gates on its campus.
No, it sure as hell didn't. In fact, I may be misremembering, but I think at one point maybe I'm conflating, but somewhere there was a rattling around my head. There's a slogan, a university without walls. Is that NYU or is it somewhere else? I think it's NYU. But yeah, there are no gates.
But yeah, at Fordham, you have a wall. My brother went to Fordham. And at Columbia, you have gates, if I'm not mistaken, over surrounding part of the campus. So how do we think about access to campus by non-students or faculty members at some of these schools, and do their past practices, or just how their campus is set up with a gate or not, lend insight into how they should respond?
Yeah, well, I mean, private campuses can limit access, and we've seen that happen at Columbia, you know, having people show their IDs and the students that are interim suspended and some faculty who they're saying, you know, we can't guarantee your safety because you're so outspoken. We're shutting off your ID so you can't come into campus as a private entity. You know, this is private property and Columbia can do that. That said, you know, it comes with consequences. There's a certain, you know, it's not a great look. But of course, Columbia does have to ensure that students and faculty have access to campus before members of the public. On public college campuses, it can look a little different. And again, it can depend on if there's state law saying, you know, these open outdoor areas of campuses are open to the public. You know, public college campuses should typically be, you know, open for all kinds of protests. You see, you know, we've got like, you know, street preachers often that will come onto public college campuses. That can be, you know, that's an important part of being on a public college campus, you know, seeing all the different speech that there is. It can be an important part of an education. So I think broadly, we want to see as long as administrators can ensure student and faculty safety and the fact that the campus can run, we want to see campuses be as open as possible to a variety of speech. That can be an important aspect of a college education. And Will, I can let you jump in. You went to NYU, the like cooler, hipper Columbia. that's how I always imagine it. It's like, you know, Columbia for hipsters.
You spent some time at Columbia though, didn't you, Alex?
I spent a summer at Columbia at their journalism school. So I know right where, you know, I was like right there where I'm, you know, all those students are in that encampment. And, you know, it was definitely open to a variety of speech when I was spending some time there. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure Columbia rejected me for undergrad. So I was very happy to go to NYU. I think there's an element of co-sponsorship in your statement, Nico. Pardon me. That's NYU right now calling to say what? Fire has fought rules against student groups interacting with larger national groups. There was a case in Texas at Tarrant County College where students wanted to have what they called an empty holster protest that they had worked out with a gun rights advocacy group, where they would attend classes wearing an empty holster to protest against the rules regarding concealed carry on campus. And they wanted to wear empty holsters, and they cleared it with the police chief ahead of time, as I recall. That would signify that they were defenseless if something were to happen on campus. And the school quashed the demonstration in part because it had been coordinated with an outside group. And Fire worked with, I want to say, the ACLU of Texas at that time. It's about 2010, so a while ago, to fight back. And the federal district court agreed with us and said, you can't restrict what students do. They have an associational right to work with groups off campus, and that kind of restriction is untenable. So there's that. And there's also the itinerant preacher cases that Alex mentioned, that, you know, in some, there's a case out of the Sixth Circuit that says in some cases the public sidewalks outside of a public university campus, especially in an urban setting, are indistinguishable from just a regular old city sidewalk. So you can't have one rule that applies to one and not the other. You know, I think that a university can make some distinctions as to who can access parts of campus with regard to their status, but Fire's argued against that. We think that university campuses should be open, particularly public university campuses.
Well, you're seeing a little bit of the shade of co-sponsorship with some of the bans on Students for Justice in Palestine. The argument is that they're supporting the actions of Hamas by organizing these protests. I think they had one document that said that they're in common cause. Is this constitutional? I mean, is...
No.
No, there's yeah, go ahead.
There's one of the foundational First Amendment student speech cases, Healy v. James, involved a prospective group of students for a democratic society at what was then Central Connecticut State College. And the university president of Central Connecticut State said, well, we've seen what SDS has done on other campuses, that they've been involved with violence, and we're not going to have that on our watch. So they denied official recognition to this group. And the Supreme Court says absolutely not, that they have an associational right, that absent some kind of clearly stated intent to violate Central Connecticut rules, you can't deny them recognition just based on affiliation some kind of action on behalf of folks who aren't on campus, that, you know, members of the national group or other groups. And I think that same principle holds, you know, and that actually, interestingly, let me just say this, you know, all this feels intensely of the moment and immediate, but it's worth recalling that these kinds of protests, even with encampments and arrests, have happened before. I was looking at newspaper reports from the 1980s at Cornell University, where in the spring of 1985, over 1,000 students and faculty were arrested for setting up shanty towns, as they called it, to protest apartheid in South Africa on campus. So really, all that's old is new again to some extent. And I don't know if that's any I don't know if that has any kind of predictive value, but it is useful just for thinking through that the current problems is that there has been a historical analog.
Yeah, we have so far 82 questions. Oh, so goodness. We're going to do our best to get through as many of them as possible. The next one I want to tee up is for you, Alex. It comes from Elise, and also John had a question along similar lines. Were the students on the UT campus doing anything illegal? This University of Texas is of Austin. What led to the kind of large police presence descending on that campus?
Yeah, as far as we can tell, no. This looks like a preemption of peaceful protest before it even began. And this is a really, you know, this is a useful juxtaposition when it comes to the kind of analysis that we do. So on Columbia's campus, you know, there's a right to peaceful protest, but these students looked like they were violating reasonable time, place, and manner regulations by camping out all day and all night. They got, you know, they had, I think, at least 24 hours notice that they were going to be interim suspended, they were going to be arrested, and then ultimately Columbia sent the cops in. Never a good look to have cops in riot gear, you know, but that's what happened there. Then we have a very different situation at UT Austin, where it appears there was nobody in violation of, you know, they hadn't even had the chance to violate reasonably implemented time, place, and manner regulations. They simply had said, you know, we are going to have a walkout for Gaza. We are going to have a protest. And the police were sent in preemptively. And we have this statement from Governor Greg Abbott saying this particular protest, expressing these particular views, I don't like, and I'm not going to allow them on our campus. And so a very different situation, the latter at UT Austin appearing to be very clearly viewpoint discriminatory to us. And we were not happy to see it. But yeah, as far as we could tell, there was no violence that would warrant police showing up. That said, you know, when we have big protests on campus, we do frequently ask college and university administrators, hey, you guys are, you know, institutions with like $1 billion endowments. Don't tell me you can't get police to be on scene just in case something goes wrong, you know, to make sure that violence doesn't erupt amidst a peaceful protest. And then you can pluck out the disruptor or disruptors so that the peaceful protest can go on, because that's the school's obligation as a public institution to honor peaceful protest. What we saw at UT Austin was a totally different situation. They were not honoring peaceful protest. They were shutting it down before it began.
We saw a lot of those sorts of arguments that you're alluding to there, Alex, in 2016, 2017, for example, where colleges and universities saying, we can't allow Ben Shapiro to appear on campus because we can't secure the premises. Well, no, that's the duty of a public institution, which is to protect constitutional rights and to have the right amount of security on hand so constitutional rights can be exercised.
Yeah, this is an old saw. Nico, I'm old enough to remember, I've worked here long enough to remember Bill Ayers, education professor, former member of the Weather Underground, during then candidate Senator Barack Obama's presidential campaign Bill Ayers was going around giving speeches on campus. And I remember, I think it was the University of Nebraska. You can check out our website, thefire.org, for more details here. But the University of Nebraska, I want to say, shut him down because of safety concerns. They said they couldn't keep him safe were he to come to campus. And that struck us then. And as I recall, I think struck a judge. I think it was challenged as being pretty ridiculous. As Alex says, these are, you know, serious entities, really kind of like small nation states, that if they can't keep a willing audience safe to hear Bill Ayers speak, then, you know, they've really got a problem. So you want law enforcement sufficient to allow for expressive activity and not law enforcement coming in to end expressive activity.
The concern and the implication in many cases is that these justifications are used as pretext to discriminate based on viewpoint. And in fact, where colleges and universities have claimed threats, we've sometimes filed public records requests and found that there was no legitimate threat actually levied against the school that would have justified shutting down the expression of constitutionally protected speech. I want to turn now to something that's somewhat similar. Sheldon asks, does the valedictorian of USC have any grounds to pursue actions against the university for not allowing her to speak? Alex, maybe you want to set that up, and Will, you can piggyback on it.
Yeah, sure.
With the story behind the USC valedictorian.
Yeah, no, but it's a big bummer for free speech at USC, and it's a bummer for the opening of commencement season, which we have historically seen be a time when controversial speakers are, you know, disinvited or deplatformed. I don't know that we've ever seen a school effectively cancel its own valedictorian before. So this is new and worse territory. So nobody has the right to be the valedictorian. That is an honor bestowed by the college at US. You know, every college is going to be different. At USC, they basically say, you know, you got to have the high GPA, and we have to take a holistic look at you as a student and who is going to be the best student to represent our university. They chose Asna Tabassum, and then the complaints about her viewpoints began, and USC pulled one of what we think is, you know, the oldest tricks in the book, saying, you know, okay, well, we're going to just not let you speak at graduation. We're not taking away your valedictorian status. We're not openly criticizing your views, but we're just going to say we can't guarantee your safety. Again, coming back to these safety rationales that are really transparent. And we see that kind of thing all the time. And now it's spiraled into, then, you know, a week later, USC is canceling all commencement speakers. And now they've canceled commencement for, I think, like 65,000 students. So, or 65,000 people that are showing up to their commencement every year. So a really bad precedent to set at the outset of commencement season, which we have historically seen is pretty dicey. But yeah, she doesn't have a, you know, any kind of legal recourse. Again, USC is a private school, but, you know, they promise free expression, another of these schools that makes First Amendment-like free speech promises. It does, once, you know, they canceled this speech, it definitely raises the specter of viewpoint discrimination, raises questions about how USC values its expressive atmosphere on campus, would raise concerns for me if I was a student or faculty member who had views similar to this valedictorian, if a USC was going to, you know, find ways to silence me in the future. Lots of questions there. Yeah, I guess I'll stop there and let Will jump in if he wants to add anything.
I don't know. You got most of it. I'll just note that in California, uniquely, there's a law called the Leonard Law, which prohibits private non-sectarian universities from punishing students for speech that would be protected by the First Amendment at a public campus. But as Alex says, we looked into this one. There's a faculty committee that recommends students for valedictorian addresses. Had this been some kind of non-discretionary function that the university was performing, we might have more grounds to be able to argue this is a punishment for protected speech rather than retraction of an invitation offered at the university's discretion. But that's not what we have here. But we did look into it.
Yeah. And, you know, one more thing I will point out is by censoring her, they really elevated her viewpoint beyond what, you know, she ever would, beyond the attention that would have ever been paid to her valedictorian speech. You know, she's on late night. She's on, you know, every cable news network. She's writing op-eds. You know, if they wanted to silence her viewpoint, here we've got the Streisand effect. They're amplifying it more than ever. So if they wanted to silence her, we see this time and again, you know, don't censor people. It backfires quite frequently.
You could make the same argument. There's not quite the, you know, it's not a one-on-one comparison, but you could make the same argument with response to the mass arrests at Columbia.
Yep.
We've got just a clarification question from Eric when we're talking about the Davis standard for peer-on-peer harassment. Severe, pervasive, and objectively offensive. What does objectively offensive even mean?
It's what a reasonable person in that circumstance would think. And that is a, you know, as you know, there's some wiggle room in there, right? It's not science. It's a holistic contextual determination.
Yeah. Also on Davis, Israel asked, but Davis was about elementary school. Would the same standard apply to college?
Yes, the same standard is applied to colleges. And it's also applied in the Title VI context. Title VI is the federal anti-discrimination law. Davis involved Title IX, which is sex-based discrimination. But Title VI is a federal anti-discrimination law that prohibits discrimination on the basis of race, color, and national origin. And for the past four presidential administrations, Bush, Obama, Trump, Biden, the Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights has interpreted that prohibition on discrimination, race, color, and national origin to include discrimination on a student's actual or perceived shared ancestry or ethnic characteristics or citizenship or residency in a country with a dominant religion or religious identity. So anti-Semitic speech or speech that is directed towards somebody because of their shared ancestry or ethnic characteristics can also qualify. And the Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights has a number of investigations right now into campuses and K-12 schools across the country for failure to address allegedly anti-Semitic hostile environment harassment. There's also private lawsuits ongoing on that front right now. So stay tuned.
Yeah, thanks for answering that. That was the next question I was going to go to from Richard, who asked about Title VI and race and religion. We also have a question from Anne. Comment on supporting free speech and upholding meaningful environment for academic education, studying for finals, noise level, walking through demonstration to get to housing or classes. This is a concern that many people have, that these protests have become so disruptive that you can't have a class, for example, that's a classroom that's on the quad without it being disrupted by amplified sound or loud chanting.
Yeah, I think John McWhorter made reference to this in his New York Times column last week. And I mean, that's right. If you have a protest, let's just say that's not, doesn't involve the encampment issue. Let's put that to the side. And the protest makes it impossible for classes to continue. Again, the university does have a substantial interest in allowing its educational operations to function and continue. The ways you might deal with that, again, are to require students to not use amplified sound, et cetera. You know, if you're dealing with something where classes can no longer continue, the university has a stronger case about regulating that expression in some way. Now, again, that's got to be a high bar. I remember when we saw at Yale last year, I think it was last year, when the head of the American Humanist Association, an attorney from, I think, the head of the Alliance Defending Freedom, a evangelical organization, were giving a speech on a Zwick-Bunim Supreme Court decision at Yale Law, and the protest was such that the event could no longer go on. Well, that's a shout down. I mean, that is preventing others from speaking. So that raises a different and competing interest. So I to the questioners, the thrust of the question, the university has to be able to continue. All right. You have to be able to attend class. That's one of the kind of, I think, one of the many very depressing things about the past couple of weeks here. In addition to the USC commencement being outright canceled, now you've got classes at Columbia having to go full remote. And I remember, I think it was somebody was a professor or involved in the in a synagogue. Somebody said that if you're a Jewish student, just don't go to campus. You can't.
Yeah, one of the rabbis, and there was some conflicting information about like the rabbi at Hillel is saying this, and somebody else is saying, you know. But you never want to have to get to that point.
No, you absolutely don't, and you need to be able to ensure that students can attend class and feel safe doing so, and you know that again. The focus of the university's response, setting aside the issue of encampments for a minute, you can ensure student safety and access without silencing speech. There is a way to do it. In fact, I think universities must do it. They have to be able to. You have to be able to allow for peaceful protest and to allow students to get their education. Those ends should not be in conflict. And if they are, as the legal director of a free speech organization, would argue that there's always a way to thread that needle.
We have a question from Jacqueline who asks, what options do colleges have to, one, define hate speech, and two, deal with it? And I'll take the moderator's prerogative here and give my thoughts first.
Yeah.
Is that hate speech exceptions to free speech standards tend to be the exception that swallow the rule, because what is considered hate speech is often very subjective. I'll recall a couple of years ago where Guy Benson, a conservative commentator, was going to speak at Brown University, and students organized a petition to get the university to ban him. And the argument was that he was going to come and spew hate speech because he supported capitalism and capitalism was a tool of white supremacy. At Emerson College a couple of years ago, for example, you had the Turning Point USA chapter there handing out stickers that said China kinda sus, which is kind of young person slang for suspicious. Protesting everything that was happening with the Chinese Communist Party and some of their actions surrounding COVID-19. The president of Emerson sent a campus-wide email accusing TPUSA of anti-Asian hate and bias and suspending the student group. Half of the student group, or a large proportion of them, were themselves Asian. One of the students was the vice president of the student group, was herself Asian. Nadine Strawson, who's a senior fellow at FIRE, wrote a great book about hate speech. I think the title is Hate, and then there's a subtitle that's escaping me. If my arms were long enough and I could reach to my bookshelf across the room, I would pull it down and read that subtitle. But she said that that's always the problem that you have with hate speech codes. In theory, they might be great, but there's always that definitional problem that does not then result in the censorship of those very viewpoints that you implement the hate speech or the hate speech code to protect. When the University of Michigan in the 1980s passed the big first hate speech code to address anti-Black racism on campus, who was the first student punished under that code? It was a Black student in the School of Social Work. Ira Glasser, who's the former executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union, talks about how in the 1970s, the National Union of Students in England was set to pass a hate speech code, and the Zionist student organization in that country supported it. A couple of years later, guess what was determined to be hate speech? Speech supporting Zionism.
Yeah, on that note, really quick, Nico, just to jump in to make it specific to this current moment, when those presidents were being excoriated for refusing to say categorically that a quote-unquote call for genocide would violate their policies and result in punishment, one of the things that FIRE pointed out, and I certainly pointed out, was that pro-Israel students, pro-Zionist voices would be, just as you say, some of the first to be punished. And sure enough, I forget what campus it was recently. There's been a lot going on. But there was a former IDF soldier coming to campus and instantly, you know, was contested, saying, how can we invite someone who's participated in and supports genocide to this campus? So those kinds of subjective restrictions, whether it's on hate speech or calls for genocide, they have a way of boomeranging and punishing exactly those who call for it. Real quick, just to answer the question, just because I know we're running out of time here, the best way to deal with this problem is to stick to the categories of expression that are not protected by the First Amendment: true threats, incitement, discriminatory harassment, properly defined. Those capture a great deal of speech that I think in the, you know, common parlance would be thought of as hate speech. And I would say that that kind of exacting, narrow viewpoint and content neutral standard is the best way out. In fact, probably the only principled way out without falling into the problem that Nico's describing so capably.
Will, can I ask you to maybe do the impossible, which is one of the questions we've got here?
Oh, boy.
And, John asks, how would a fire-informed university president have answered Congresswoman Elise Stefanik's question, does calling for the genocide of Jews violate your university's rules on bullying and harassment? I want to preface this by also saying that leading up to that question, there was a conversation around whether from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, chance of intifada were happening and allowed on their campus, the implication being that they would be unprotected speech. And then also Elise Stefanik asked each of the university presidents, MIT, Harvard, and Penn, to answer in one word. Is it possible to answer a question about unprotected speech in one word?
Yeah, I mean, the answer would be maybe, right? And then the answer would be if it meets the standard for true threats, incitement, discriminatory harassment, or is accompanied by violence, then absolutely it's punishable. Otherwise, it's a context-specific determination. And I think what the university presidents failed to do, and what I'm happy to do here now, I think any kind of realistic appraisal of the current moment requires it, is to recognize that students are freaked out. And that is a common thread throughout all of this, both the different quote-unquote sides on the pro-Israel or pro-Palestinian side. Students are feeling they're first of all grieving, they're feeling under siege, they are exhausted, they are freaked out in two words. And so I would acknowledge the pain that can accompany those words. Nothing in the First Amendment requires us to say these words can't be harmful. In fact, it's because of that pain and because of the anguish that words can inspire that's the very reason they're protected, because we don't trust the government to arbitrate the use of that kind of power that words have and words carry. I mean, I would refer everybody to Snyder v. Phelps. Chief Justice Roberts, you know, we don't ignore the fact that, I'm paraphrasing wildly here, that words can cause great pain. It's in fact precisely because that we don't let the government regulate them. I would have answered like that. Representative Stefanik would not have liked it, but it is the only correct answer from a free speech advocacy point of view, and it is what the First Amendment requires. And I would rather train tomorrow's leaders in free speech and the value of the First Amendment and the need for principle than I would in sacrificing those values for political expediency, because we know that sooner or later, the shoe will be on the other foot.
Well, that's exactly the argument that Aryeh Nair made in the late 1970s. Aryeh Nair was the head of the American Civil Liberties Union, the National ACLU, during the Skokie case. This is the case in which a small band of neo-Nazis wanted to rally in a town that where 6,000 Holocaust survivors lived. Aryeh Nair was himself a Holocaust survivor. He and his family escaped Germany, Berlin, in fact, when he was two, and they learned that their extended family all perished or murdered in the war. And he said that one of the questions that he most frequently got leading the ACLU at that time was, how can you, a Jew, defend freedom for the Nazis? He would receive angry letters from supporters, and one proposed a new motto for the ACLU, First Amendment Uber Alles. And he said, and he writes in his book, Defending My Enemy, which I'd encourage everyone on this call to listen to, which is his case for why we should defend even the speech rights of those who would call for our elimination. His argument was that the chances are best for preventing a repetition of the Holocaust in a society where every incursion on freedom is resisted. He writes, freedom has its risks, but suppression of freedom, I believe, is a prescription for disaster.
Right.
And he also argues that the lesson of Germany in the 1920s is that a free society cannot be established and maintained if it will not act vigorously and forcefully to punish political violence. Goes on to say, violence is the antithesis of speech. Through speech, we try to persuade others with the use of our ideas, Violence, on the other hand, terrorizes with the force of arms. It shuts off opposing points of view. So we have a reading list for folks here. Defending My Enemy by Arye Nair, and also Nadine Strossen's book, Hate. Alex, I want to give you the closing word. If you can just kind of tie a bow on where things are at, and also just like the situation on college campuses for freedom of speech has been challenging for years, hasn't it? Like, this isn't, it's not like we woke up 2 weeks ago and all of a sudden free speech was in crisis on these campuses. We keep waiting for the dull week at FIRE, and it just hasn't come, has it?
Shh, don't say that. don't drink that. Yeah, you know, one of the things that initially occurred to me and the folks on our team was just, in some ways, it's not surprising that here we are at this moment. It seems in many ways like a natural consequence or, you know, coalescing of a lot of the really subpar free speech policies and free speech practices and those, you know, pro-speech mindsets that we have seen just really devolve on campuses for at least the better part of a decade. You know, students, you know, more than a decade ago, you know, for when FIRE started, students were a pretty good constituency for free speech on campus. You know, it was administrators that we were looking at. Now, you know, students, many students care about free expression, but not too many. There are more than we would like that, you know, would prefer things like bias response type teams and hate speech restrictions for whatever side, for, you know, against whatever side they disagree with ideologically. So we have been urging college and university administrators, particularly since October 7th, to say, look, this is a teachable moment. All the things that we've been telling you for years, decades here at FIRE, it has come to a head now that, you know, post October 7th, what side, for example, as a campus administrator, can you reliably take? Can you take a political or, you know, political side when it comes to Israel-Palestine? Not if you don't want to anger, you know, half of your constituency. So here's a great example of why you should commit to things like institutional neutrality, saying we as a institution are going to be the host and sponsor of critics, not the critic itself. We're not going to put a thumb on the scale of the debate here. Instead, we're going to return to our viewpoint content neutral free expression policies. We're going to make sure those policies treat everyone equally. We're going to give everybody due process. We're going to lean into these moments when students are saying, we want to talk about this stuff. We're passionate about what's happening in Israel and in Gaza. And instead of just, you know, playing censorship whack-a-mole, instead saying, we are going to marshal all our resources to make sure that you guys can have these discussions, the skills to have these discussions, the desire to talk across lines of difference in a way that is exactly the purpose of a college or university. We think universities and colleges are missing this important moment. We want them to meet the moment so we at FIRE don't have to. We don't have to start, you know, writing them letters and say, you know, you're doing it wrong. We want them to know what their job is and to do it well. That's what we want to go out of business still. And yet, after 25 years, we would love to not be here.
I am reading the comments right now, and Israel and Craig inform me that Defending My Enemy by Arye Nair costs $400 on Amazon.
Is that right? I'm sure
it might not be in print anymore. I don't know.
Well, I remember I got my version on eBay maybe 10 years ago or so, and this is where I like to plug a library. So if your library doesn't have a copy, you should demand it. Get one.
Well, actually, you know, I'll take moderator's prerogative here. Can you just like kind of 1 minute explain what the purpose of a civil liberties organization is?
Yeah, we're here no matter what, right? That's one thing I want to reinforce for everybody on the call. Over the 16 years I've now been doing this work, we have defended both sides of this question, that is pro-Israel, pro-Palestinian speech, repeatedly. And that's on almost every other major question I can think of, from abortion to animal rights, partisan politics, you name it. Our mission here is to defend speech if it's protected. That's it. That's the only rule. And we want to be, and I would argue that our record demonstrates this, to be very consistent. We stay in the same place no matter what. That's the role of a principled, effective civil liberties organization. That's certainly what we're doing here at FIRE. So if these answers today feel difficult or challenging, I get it. But we will give that same defense to all speech, including some speech you like. Right? If you don't like this speech, stay tuned. The weather will change, and we will be there all the same. That's the work that we have in front of us. That's the work we've been doing proudly. And that's the work it's my honor to continue to do.
And we'll drive this bus into the wall if that's what it takes to remain principled. Because when you're a free speech advocacy organization, all you have are your principles.
That's all you got.
So I'm very honored to work both with you, Will Creeley, our legal director, and Alex Morey, our new vice president of campus advocacy. I want to apologize. We have 93 still open questions. We only budgeted an hour for this conversation, but I would encourage you, if you enjoy these conversations and want a better chance of your question being answered live during the conversation, become a FIRE member. This conversation was open to the public, but we have once monthly FIRE member only calls with a smaller group of people where we will do our best to get to your question. And some of the FIRE folks might be following up with you personally to the extent we can. This conversation is also going to be hosted on the FIRE podcast, so to speak, the Free Speech Podcast, where I am your host, Nico Perino. I didn't introduce myself at the top, but I suspect listeners too, so to speak, are familiar with my voice. And of course, all of you participating here on Zoom can see my name and title conversation. If you're interested in subscribing to So to Speak, where we cover all sorts of free speech topics and have done so for, it's hard to believe, I think 7 years now, go on to any podcast app, subscribe. And if you enjoy what you listen to, please rate and review. And until next time, I thank you all for attending and thank you for your good questions. Will and Alex, thank you for your good answers.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Nico. Sure.